You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read. The cow goes moo.
Hi, welcome to Bookworm. This is Michael Silverblatt, and my guest today is Norman Mailer. We're celebrating the publication of his new monumental book, Harlot's Ghost. I wanted to begin by, I guess, referring to the end of an interview in your book, Pieces and Pontifications. You mentioned back then that you hadn't had as much of a chance to read as you'd been wanting to, and now that you've at least reached a hiatus in the Harlot's Ghost cycle, you have that chance. If you were to be able to reload the mind computer, what would you fill it in with?
What would I
now
read?
Yes, what would you be reading now?
Oh, I think I would catch up on a great many of the Europeans, Calvino for one. I don't know all of them. My mind boggles before the 15 or 20 important European writers I haven't read at all. I'd catch up with some of the younger writers here. I might sit down and read a great many of the women who've been developing reputation. I mean, I haven't even read Anne Tyler yet. And then, I don't know, you know, you start thinking about that. It's ridiculous. It's like how many, you know, if you can make love to all the women in the world you want to make love to, who would you start with? So you say, well, Cleopatra. And you start going through it all. Uh-huh. I don't know. I'd like to, there's all the rereading I'd like to do. It'd be fun to reread Karl Marx and the New Testament. There's so many things to read. I'd reread Remembrance of Things Past. So I just don't know. The fact of the matter is I don't read. I never have time to read anymore. I read functionally. I read what I need to read for my next book. For instance, I'm doing a short book on Picasso now. So what do? I read books on Picasso. And, I have a thesis, and I don't want to write it too exclusively, so I read as much as I can in order to see if people have said some of the things I'm saying before. And it's ending up being a bit of a quiet, scholarly little work. And then when I'm done with it, I'll be going back to this, to Harlot's Ghost. So in that sense, I may not have a chance to read until another 10 years go by or whatever. I keep thinking if I can just get to be economically self-sufficient.
Uh-huh.
You so know, no, if I could live on the money I've earned or something like that, then I could read.
There's no keeping an eye on the talent in the room anymore. It's not important.
Oh, I don't care about that anymore. God, let them. We're an endangered species. Let them all thrive.
Tell me, if you were going to start a career, say, as Joyce Carol Oates has, as a novelist with a different name, and you wanted it to be completely unsuspected that Norman Mailer was going into this cottage industry, what kind of book would you turn to?
You know, I don't have an idea. I never know what kind of book I'm going to turn to next anyway. I really don't. I'd like to... It's almost impossible to answer that, because if I can answer that, then I know what my next book is going to be. At the moment, I think my next book is going to be a sequel to Harlot's Ghost. It isn't necessarily going to be that. It could start out to be that and become something else altogether. I've made promises before of books I was going to write, and then I almost never fulfilled them. I wrote another book instead. Some years ago, I spoke of a three-phase novel I was going to write, a huge three-phase novel, which Ancient Evenings was going to be the first novel, and the second was going to be a work of science fiction, and the third book was going to be contemporary. And the second book never got written. It never started. I started reading some science fiction. I said, these guys are too good. I'm not going to be able to digest what they're doing. I don't longer have enough mentality left to comprehend all that they're doing and do something better. It can't be done. So I gave up the scheme.
You seem to be, although I know earlier in your career, people speak of you as having at one time been a depressed writer, but you seem to be the antidote to depression. America's spiritual disease right now seems to have gone past cancer to something more simple, an inability to rouse itself, a kind of anemia. But you seem to be a thoroughly mobilized writer.
Well, I've had luck in a lot of ways. You know, in that, first of all, I think one's lucky to be a writer. I haven't had to use a lot of my youth and middle age working at a job I did not really completely like, that chewed me up slowly. And whatever it is, I just feel that, you know, that since I believe in karma, I don't take vows for any of this, since I feel maybe I was given a little more than other people get, and therefore I better do more with it. Because if I don't, my next job in life, in my next life, might be much less interesting. And I might be having to make amends for everything I've had in this life. So in that sense, you see, I'm always living in these pious equations. And but if I have more, if I have some energy at this age, 68, then I'm delighted. You know, let me keep as much of it as I can and do as much work as I can. Because Elia Kazan at Actors Studio once said something wonderful. He was addressing us. He's marvelously dynamic. He's now in his late 70s. He's huge energy, and you know, you feel cerebrality in him. His forehead almost throbs as he thinks and speaks. And he turned to us at one point, he was talking about work, and the Actors Studio, they're always talking about the work process. And he said, he was talking about, yes, we're obsessed with the work, and we talk about it, we think about it, it's very important. It's very important to work when you're in the theater. In fact, he said, work is a blessing. And I thought, he's absolutely right, of course. So I complain less when I have to work now on a novel than I used to. It's the only form of blessing I'm likely to receive, is that I'm able to work.
How do you go about writing a novel like Harlot's Ghost, which seems to me to be the most complicated of any book you've undertaken so far? I mean, it's in mere terms of its plotting and its density of plot, it seems to be a real, you know, tour de force, and it looks like Tough Guys Don't Dance was sort of practice for the prologue of this book.
Well, Tough Guys Don't Dance was written, the first draft was written in 2 months, and they were most intense 2 months, but this one took 7 years, so there's the difference. It was really like writing a huge history. I had to stop all the time and make sure of my facts and read several books sometimes before I could advance one chapter further. And then there were periods where I had to stop for 3 months and read a great many books all related to the subject and digest them. Digestion is the most important part of writing, because if you can't, then it just ends up sticking in the work and it doesn't feel right. It's got to become your own. You somehow have got to read these works, digest them, and then it feels as if it's coming out of your imagination, as if you're writing out of your own experience. And that's a subtle mental, I wouldn't call it a discipline, but it's a mental accomplishment that you get after you've been writing for decades. Being a writer in a certain sense for many, many decades is a little bit like being a Zen warrior. That is, Zen warriors can do something in the 50th and 60th year of their life that they couldn't do when they were 20, because they've kept working at the same spiritual discipline. And in a way, even for atheists, novel writing is a spiritual discipline. So, in fact, I recommend it to atheists.
Hugh Kenner had pointed out, I think correctly, that the model, in a sense, for Executioner's Song, at least the root sentence, was a Sherwood Anderson sentence, a kind of plain, unadorned, sad, factual sentence.
He might be absolutely right. I never thought of it, but Weinsberg had a huge, huge influence on me. And I read it in college. It's one of those books that... See, I've learned an awful lot about influence, and I find it fabulous, and I underline the word, because I read The Education of Henry Adams in my freshman year at Harvard. Not out of choice. It was given to us. And at the time, I didn't think much of it. I thought, who's this odd man, Henry Adams, who writes about himself in the third person? What an odd way to do things. I don't really like it much. And that was all. You know, I could see that the man could write well, and that was the end of it. I never thought about The Education of Henry Adams again until, now, I was at Harvard, and my first year was 1939, and so it was almost 30 years later, 28 years later, I started writing about the March on the Pentagon, and I couldn't get the book going for a couple of days, and I was in a panic because it was a magazine article that I had a hand in a certain period of time. And then on a given day, I just cut loose in the third person, and before long, I realized I was writing a book that was very much in the mode of The Education of Henry Adams. So Henry, that had obviously been a huge influence on me, but I never paid any attention to it. So at the same time, I think Weinsberg, I have to hand it to Kenner, Weinsberg may literally have been the specific influence for the tone, the voice, and the Executioner Song. That sad, removed voice that's so tender toward all the people, because as if there's a huge sky brooding over them.
Exactly, yeah.
And
it's also as if, you know, in order to begin Harlot's Ghost, one would want a node sentence of enormous complexity, full of causal modification and you know, harumphing, you know, the sound of static going on to interrupt.
Oh, I hope not.
I think, you know, well, you know, to do this artistically, to do it vitally, but nevertheless to...
I'd rather do it less artistically than skip the static.
Well, I think of all of those sounds that interrupt Richard Nixon's tapes, you know, that something of this sort has to go on, that there has to be a synapse burst somewhere when you're writing about the CIA.
I mean, look at the pain we had listening to those damn tapes, those Watergate tapes. You couldn't hear a word. The amount of man hours that went into trying to interpret what they literally said because you couldn't hear it. Sound experts had to go over it. It was like combing lice out of an absolutely infested head.
It's sort of strange, actually, to in the wake of the Thomas hearings, to be aware that, you know, America not very long ago was a country that heard its politicians speaking in constant expletive deleteds, and now to be hearing these men in their chambers talking about the shock of hearing the word dong in an office, you know, it's a very, you know, I'm not speaking for or against anyone, but I think that there's a hypocrisy of...
You know, one thing I was struck with in the Thomas hearings, I don't want to go on about it too much because, I'm talked out on it virtually, but one thing that did strike me that was fascinating is there was a panel of 9 women I heard last night. I think it was the last night of the hearings. And every one of them just about spoke of being harassed. And I thought, most of the women I know, I haven't spent my life listening to women tell me about how they were harassed. Of course, I've never worked in an office. But it occurred to me, maybe, and this is just a wild speculation, but maybe it's in bureaucracies that most of the sexual harassment goes on. Maybe there's something in the nature of bureaucracy where it's so boring and where people feel so confined in their lives that unruly impulses tend to build up and build up. And so men who normally look like reasonable gray animals, gray human animals, suddenly start harassing women out of the sheer madness of living and working within a bureaucracy. I wonder if statistically there'd be any basis to it. I have a hunch there is.
Well, it must have something to do with the modern office furniture, the walls
the
that don't go to
lighting.
The ceilings. Yes.
You know, you'd have to almost, it isn't a matter of harassing women. It's as if women would almost in turn have to harass men back because of that damn fluorescent lighting. It's killing. It's soul deadening.
Well, I think there is something here because it's not just that... you know, all of these women were harassed. It's also that every time one turns around, one meets another friend who vividly remembers incestuous incidents from their childhood. And I think, you know, could it always have been the case? I mean, are all of us in some crazy way the product of some kind of incestuous tampering? No, there's something, maybe it's the light that's causing us to remember this in such...
Or misremember,
right, in such martial force.
I must say, for better or for worse, I remember no sexual tampering with me when I was a child. No incest. Many people have spoken to me about it, but I always listened with wonder.
Astonishment, yeah.
I came from a good Jewish home. It was unheard of. I mean, I don't know how much sex there was at all in the home. Sex was something that was for the Gentiles.
It's changed.
It's changed. 800 years of oppression, suddenly people cut through.
But it does strike me that right now there is something that is compelling people to feel sexually oppressed in their past, in their present. I don't know that it's made up, but there is some crazy anguish.
Oh, AIDS. I mean, the idea that you can, the idea of sexual pleasure may be very dangerous to your health is, we're right back in the middle of the Victorian period. The real effects of AIDS are not going to be felt for another 10 or 20 years, but I can see in my children, they have all the aptitude for a healthy and various sex life, they're really quite abstemious. And as they go, so goes the rest of the youth in this nation. So there's a very funny attitudes about sex now. I mean, 20 or 30 years ago, nobody, I think, would have taken the idea of sexual harassment seriously. It was just considered part of the mating game. You know, if a guy had bad manners and went too far and he was a lout, well, he didn't score. You know, that used to be the attitude. I remember, when I was younger, older guys giving me advice and saying, well, you got to treat women this way and that way, and you must never do this. You can't go too far than that. On the other hand, never take no for an answer. And it was all this, this sort of, what you might say, this lore that was half compounded of ignorance and garbage, but nonetheless it was what we worked on. You know, I grew up with the idea, oh, no, you know, it was hard enough to make a pass at a woman, but the idea was never take no for an answer, because the woman really means yes. You know, culturally, it was a period where I'd say 9 out of 10 men believe that.
But I think as well, and I don't think I've heard anyone say this, there's an enormous fear on people's part to be the object of desire, to cause desire.
Well, there you may have something.
I think
certain people, not all.
Not all people, but
I think I can. You gave me an idea. I think it's people who have set their course in life, and they're what I would call uni-souls. That is, they do not really want to have a deep relation with anyone else, because that will deter them from their objective. It's as if the navigator in them has lined up their sights and have said to them, "You are a torpedo. And if nothing deters you, you will be a huge success. You will blow up that huge target that is at the very end of your ambition, and you will be immortal. And so don't let anything get in your way. Just be a torpedo." Well, people like that, sexual harassment is absolutely outrageous. And it's interesting that that women in who are leading feminism very often are that way. That is, they are single-minded in their goals. Feminism is their life. They see nothing to the left or to the right of feminism. It's not like, let's improve men and women together, or let's try to rise to a higher level of human relations. It's feminism is the most important single thing in their lives, and they work for it 24 hours a day. They're devoted to it. And they, too, are torpedoes. You know, they've got one goal.
But I don't know if it's even characteristically feminism. What I notice living here in Los Angeles, I mean, which people call nowadays the least sexy city in America, the most beautiful-looking people and the least sexually inclined people, very low libido levels. The look is meant to create attraction, but there's a strong do not touch, because exactly that torpedo factor you're talking about, people wanting to spring themselves into the future and land at the center of the bullseye, and along that trajectory, attraction and dalliance can only be an interruption. I think it's yuppies. You know, I think that is the refocusing.
Feminism and yuppiedom came into power at the same time, and they are complementary to one another, absolutely. You never hear a yuppie making an anti-feminist remark.
Why is that?
Well, I think they feel a simultaneity of needs, desires, and directions. And also, they're separate torpedoes. Why should they ever make a nasty remark to one another? That might deflect them. They're not going to cross. They never will hit each other and explode.
In Harlot's Ghost, and talking to Norman Mailer, whose new novel, Harlot's Ghost, was just published by Random House, in Harlot's Ghost, there is a good deal of sexual jostling of a sort that I guess is created by the formation of male groups like the CIA and the OSS before it. And into it, you've injected Hadley. How, I don't know personally, how common are women like Hadley in structures like the CIA?
You mean?
Your character.
Kittredge Gardner Montague.
Yes.
Hadley Kittredge Gardner Montague. Yes. You're the only one who ever called her Hadley.
Oh.
She's named after Hemingway's first wife.
I thought so.
Because
yes.
Her father met her once, met Hadley Hemingway in Paris once in his youth, and thought she was the most wonderful woman he'd ever met, so he named his daughter Hadley after I think her name was Richardson. Hadley Richardson Hemingway, was it? I don't remember. So you were in all this. I forgot the question you asked me about Hadley.
I asked you. Okay, Hadley Kittredge, Montague. I was asking about women in the CIA. Women like.
Well, she's a character I created. I just wanted to. I felt I've been writing all these years. I've never attempted to create a full-fledged woman of high intelligence, at least by my measure. I mean, my idea of a woman with high intelligence, if someone's much brighter than I am, they might say, well, she's a woman of only mediocre intelligence. Mailer's not that bright himself. I wanted to write a woman who would be up there. Not, you know, you can never write a character who's more intelligent than yourself. You can pretend to, but you can't really. If they're going to live with them through an entire work, they really have to. They can reach your level of intelligence at best. So let's say that I've created a woman who's 90% as intelligent as I am, but I wanted to do that. A woman who was really percipient and who just had a different set of perceptions than I am. I didn't want her to be a mouthpiece for me. That's dreadful. So I confess that I'm pleased with her. I feel I created a woman who's real, who has a great many passions in her, who has discrimination, who has taste, who can be very tough. She'd be a bad woman to have in a social group if she
too.
Didn't like you.
That's yes.
And at the same time, very attractive, and that's my woman in this book. I think I finally created a major lead character in the shape of a woman.
What will happen to her?
In the next book? The next book is all for her. I might almost call it Kittredge. Not a bad idea. Michael, I'm getting too many ideas this morning.
I'm in trouble now. when you do the next book, the next volume of Harlot's Ghost, will it be necessarily, is it obliged to be as lengthy as this one?
No, hopefully it won't be, but I never trust myself on length because I become fascinated with things that I'd never... Right now I'm thinking that it's got to have a lot to do with Vietnam and Watergate and also the real love affair of Harry Hubbard and Hadley Kittredge Gardner Montague. And that should be a hell of a love affair if I can do it properly, but I know myself wanting to know, and also Harry's trip through the Soviet Union. But I know myself wanting to know that something else is going to come into the book. If it doesn't, I'm in trouble. If that's all that happens in the next book, it won't be too interesting. Something's going to happen, either with the form, the treatment, the subject matter. I've got to surprise myself. So it's anyone's guess what it'll be in the next book.
Does this mean for people who are waiting that we will find Harlot again?
Well, we will or we won't. I can't answer that since I haven't decided. I believe in an organic novel, that you don't know what your end is as you write,
mm-hmm.
that you write toward an end, but at the last moment you can be diverted from that end to another end. And obviously if Harlot is not in the sequel, then it will be a less interesting book than if he is. So it's probably 3 or 4 to 1 that Harlot will appear.
I was thinking about your comments about exhaustiveness.
Mon's comment.
Yes.
Yeah. Only the exhaustive is truly interesting.
Could you speak about that a little bit? Because it seems to me, for instance, that, this is not true. that, for instance, why are we in Vietnam? Sometimes the skyrocket is equally interesting as the exhaustive and fatiguing.
Well, there are people who think Why Are We in Vietnam is my best book, and it's certainly my shortest book and my funniest book. And there are great virtues to being short, many, many, many virtues. But I do think there's something about searching through a subject until indeed you are exhaustive about it, you've covered every aspect of it, that gives us a greater sense of life as we live it. I mean, there are any number of books we read and enjoy precisely because they don't remind us too much of life. They're special. They're dreams. They're visions. They're escapades. But they are out of our life stream. But I think if you want to write a book that brings people into a deeper sense of what their own lives are like, you've got to create characters in your book who truly grow as the reader comes in contact with them, so that the narrator is not the same person at the end of the book they were at the beginning, but they change very slowly, almost imperceptibly. And for that, you've got to go through a great deal of experience, because as we go through our own lives and look back on them, we can't, with the exception of a few dramatic episodes, we can't point to the given day when we changed our mind about something very important in our life. Often it took 2, 3, 8 years. When we think about the various loves we've had in our lives and the way they end, some end quickly, some fade out slowly, some remain. All that is part of the course of a life. A life is like a river. And you have to almost go through that river and boat all the way down it to say you know the river. So in that sense, only the exhaustive is truly interesting, because what I believe is true is that there's something analogous to those people who won't even do a 26-mile marathon. They'll do a 100-mile marathon, because obviously they go through spiritual states in the course of getting that exhausted that take them into places they would not otherwise have reached. Now, I'm not making that claim for this book. That was Mon's claim. I don't want this book to be a 1,300-page book that is exhaustive. I want it to be a 1,300-page book that reads all the way, where people finish it and they say, gee, I really am so sorry that I'm done, because I don't know if I'm ready to go back and reread it again, but I can't think of anything else I want to read at this point. Well, that would be the ideal for me.
They have the promise of another
No, but they may not want to wait 3 years. So if they reread this one, then they can get a better notion of what the next one might be like.
Well, they can go and read Ancient Evenings.
I mean, that they can do, yes.
Many of them, you know, sort of slid through that one, you know, without much, you know, sticking. So, you know.
Yeah, that was a tough book for a lot of people.
Why do you suppose that was?
Oh, a lot of reasons. I think a lot of people are just not that interested in ancient Egypt. And I know I wasn't until I started getting into the book. And then the names were very difficult, worse than one's first contact with the Russian novel. Remember when you come across those names that were different on every page because of the patronymic in the middle and all that? Well, here you'd have names like Amenhep Shuef, as an example, and I don't know, I don't even remember some of the long names in that book, but they were very long and very hard to remember, and the proof is that the author doesn't even remember all the names now. I remember Ramses II had something like 30 names and was called by about, six or eight of them in the course of the novel, and then the form of address in ancient Egypt was so slow and so stately, you know, you wouldn't just say, King, how do you feel about things? You would say, oh, most exalted, oh, he before whom I bow the knee, oh, he who holds the heavens in his left hand and the earth in his right, oh, he who, when he defecates, makes a sound more wondrous than any ever heard before, and on and on and on through all of his bodily functions, his loves, his attainments, and all this, all to say hello to the king.
Good morning.
So the book has a stately quality that I think just repelled a great many people.
Well, it's a sort of funny thing because I just as you speak of the spiritual state of going through a lengthy procedure of writing, which obviously involves, you know, all sorts of preparation and healthfulness, in reading, that mere and repeated act, I know you think that repetition kills the soul, but of running one's eyes from the left to the right, from the left to the right, is itself a trance state, and it cannot be too long.
Oh, that's not repetition. That's rhythm. That's not repetition.
Well, it's
rhythm is where you're making the same physical movement while something different is occurring in your brain.
Mm-hmm.
Just as the same thing can be occurring in one's brain as when one recites a mantra, but the body is entering into different states as you do it. So that's not repetition. Repetition is when the body and the brain are doing the same thing over and over and over. If I answer the same question on media 5 times in a day, by the end of it, my body is in the same clenched position, and my mind is in exactly the same place, and I'm on top of that, I'm having the added woe of hearing the sound of my own voice, and I'm in misery. Repetition of that sort does kill the soul.
I'm speaking to Norman Mailer, whose book, Harlot's Ghost, which I recommend very highly, has just been published by Random House. Thank you. It was a pleasure to see you and to meet you.
Yeah, this was fun.
It was fun. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Jerry Summers. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of ice and snow in books. As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages, back to days of old when knights were bold, and books, 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 books can be funny too. Books make you laugh and sing, books tell you everything, they're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme. Now with book of the mouse, wow.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.